I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's December 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. Cognitive dysfunction is a common symptom of multiple sclerosis, at some point affecting more than half the people living with MS. And while cognitive issues like changes in memory, attention, information processing speed, and executive functions may not be among the most disabling symptoms of MS, they may be among the most disconcerting symptoms. Whether it's your short-term memory, the ability to find your way to a familiar destination that you've gone to hundreds of times, or your ability to follow conversations with friends or business colleagues, these are the kinds of real-world situations that can bring someone to a hard stop, recognizing that they're changing in profound ways that aren't outwardly apparent. And that's a scary feeling. Fortunately, researchers are making real progress in developing ways for people living with MS to improve their cognition. And joining me to talk about what researchers are learning and what types of cognitive rehabilitation are available today is Dr. Nancy Chiravalotti. Dr. Chiravalotti is a director of the Center for Neuropsychology and Neuroscience Research and the Center for Traumatic Brain Injury Research at Kessler Foundation. She's also a research professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. And Dr. Chiravalotti's research is focused on cognitive rehabilitation, particularly in ways to stimulate new learning, memory, and processing speed. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Chiravalotti, there are a few other things that you should know about. About 95% of the world's population carries the Epstein-Barr virus, and clearly 95% of the world's population does not have multiple sclerosis. So we always want to keep in mind that the Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV, isn't the cause, but it's been shown to be a necessary trigger for MS. And experts have hypothesized that eliminating the Epstein-Barr virus would eliminate most of the MS in the world. Since it was announced that EBV triggers MS and some cancers, there's been a concentrated effort within the research community to develop an EBV vaccine. And a company called EBViously has shared some very encouraging news about EBV-001, their experimental EBV vaccine. EBViously is a spin-off of Helmholtz Munich, part of a German government research network. And I may not be giving this company too much credit for naming things, including their own company name and the name of their experimental EBV vaccine, but they get lots of credit for reporting that in a preclinical study, EBV-001 triggered a strong antibody response against the Epstein-Barr virus in mice. And then blood samples from these lab mice were shown to prevent EBV infection in lab-grown human cells. This potential breakthrough represents an encouraging step forward in developing an EBV vaccine. Once the company completes confirmation of the data from this preclinical study, they plan on applying for regulatory clearance to proceed with a Phase 1 clinical trial in 2024. The initial clinical trial will be aimed at preventing mononucleosis due to EBV infection. As we move into 2024, I'm looking forward to reporting further developments as several research teams continue their work on a vaccine that holds a promise of eliminating most of the MS in the world. In so many past podcast episodes, you've heard me refer to a researcher or a clinician as a fellow. And you may have wondered what a fellow is and what a fellow does. Dr. Nouriel Maghavan has just completed his fellowship at the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine. Currently, he is practicing at LA General Hospital, which is part of the USC Health Sciences campus. And he's joining us today to explain what being a fellow is all about. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Maghavan.
Thanks, John. Really excited to be chatting.
To give us some context, how does someone become a fellow, and why does someone become a fellow?
You know, I think it maybe even helps there to, you know, I'm going to assume nothing. And so I think even just to take people through, you know, what does it mean to become an MS specialist, you know, along the whole course of one's education, at least in the U.S. So to be a fellow, you need to have completed residency, completed med school, repeated, you know, college. So really to be a physician in the U.S., you need to do a four-year degree that's pre-medical in some way. You need to go through 4 years of medical school. And then if you're a neurologist, you do a residency. It's also 4 years long. And that's a period where you are learning everything about every neurological condition. So you're learning about strokes. You're learning about epilepsy, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. You're also learning about MS. And, you know, in that four-year period, you're going to see the things that are the most common, which means you're not going to see MS that often. Even in the best programs, you know, the best residencies at places that have large MS centers, there isn't that much time to learn about MS. And as we know, it's such a complex field and it changes so quickly. And what an MS fellowship is actually then training after residency, often for 1 to 2 years, but sometimes longer, specifically in multiple sclerosis. And this is something someone might pursue if they want to be an MS specialist, because at the end of the day, and I think people living with MS know this, you know, when you see somebody who's an MS specialist who's trained specifically in that and keeping up to date with the latest, who understands how to monitor some of these drugs that, you know, have risk, that the care is just at a little bit of a higher level. And so a fellow then is somebody who's pursuing that extra training. So they've completed residency. They are a neurologist. They're often board certified and are honestly foregoing going straight into practice, deep in paying those loans for a few more years while being paid resident wages, but to learn more and to be able to care for people a little bit better. And so, you know, why did I become an MS fellow, to answer your question? You know, I really wanted to be good at that. You know, I wanted to make sure that when I was taking care of somebody living with MS, I was doing it in a way where I really understood what is the disease process. What is it like for somebody living with MS? What are the main challenges? I want to learn everything about the 20 plus drugs that are available so I can find and match, you know, what is the best medication for this individual patient's lifestyle. So, and also to be an MS trained physician, you are also particularly good at certain things. You're particularly good at reading MRIs. You're particularly good at looking at eyes. Because of, you know, optic nerve involvement, optic neuritis, you're particularly good at thinking about bladder control. You're particularly, so some things that you just don't learn in neurology residency as much, you get really good at. And so some of it was also just knowing that it's a deeper level of training. So multifactorial, John, but, you know, to be an MS fellow really is to want to take care of people living with MS at a higher level.
Can you walk us through what a typical day looks like for an MS fellow?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're a fellow, you are typically training at somewhere that is itself, you know, a comprehensive MS center. So not every place has a fellowship. I mean, you really need to be an institution that devotes itself to educating fellows and showing that that's actually part of your work, and having a substantial number of people living with MS in your clinic. And so the typical day for an MS fellow, and maybe a better way to put it, a typical week, because you're doing so many different things. But, you know, let's say my typical Monday when I was in fellowship was, you know, in the mornings I'd be in clinic with one of our attendings. So when I was at USC on Mondays, I was either with Dr. Amesqua, who was our fellowship director and is primarily responsible for training us. And if you come through USC, you really are working very closely with her. Dr. Azevedo and Dr. Peltier. So, you know, we'd be rotating through any of their clinics. And, you know, that affords you an opportunity also to see what their particular styles are. Every physician has a little bit of a different way of practicing. So, you know, it gives us a breadth of actually learning experiences to be with different attendings that we'd rotate through in the morning. And then in the afternoons on Mondays, for instance, that would be time where I'd be catching up with patient messages. So for patients over the weekend who had questions, needed refills on their medication, maybe we're having some new symptoms that needed investigating. You know, I'd be following up with folks who had messaged us. And at least the way our clinic is at USC, the fellows are in some ways the primary point of contact too, to make sure that the patients are well taken care of in between visits. Maybe later on that Monday, I will have come across a question in the clinic in the morning where I didn't know the answer. Okay, then I'm spending some time reading and trying to learn, because really that's really the primary purpose of a fellowship, is to try to gain that higher level of understanding. But across a week, you know, it's really this blend. It's direct patient care, it's indirect patient care through the chart, it's education through, you know, self-taught, you know, through reading, but also we typically have lectures. And then it's our own research. So for many fellowships, there's a strong research component. So a lot of that time is also spent generating new knowledge to advance the field. So it's a really kind of honestly fun time where you have this ability to be seeing patients and getting to know people and learning and indulging a little bit in the kind of nerdy, curious part of most doctors' brains.
Was there anything about becoming a fellow at USC that surprised you?
I think in becoming a fellow at USC, but I think in general, there are a few things that you just don't encounter. And you start in residency, you know, you're coming from residency. And to be honest, most residents are pretty burned out by the end of the residency. It's a pretty intensive time. When you hear about residency, like even as a non-physician, you probably think of like, oh, I, you know, my cousin's friend, whoever just like was working 80 hours a week and never slept. And so, you know, first things first, fellowship is nice because you actually are now living a little bit more of a regular schedule. And so some of it was actually just that transition was nice. And it in certain ways, it allowed me to sort of reconnect a little bit more with myself and why I went into medicine. And with a period too, where again, that kind of bit of indulgence I was talking about where, you know, I just really like to get to know people. I really like to learn things. And so some of it was almost the surprise of like, oh, I have an opportunity now again. I'm not working, you know, grinding at 70 hours a week, staying up all night and, you know, working the night. But I actually really get to do the kind of doctory things I always wanted to do. So it almost sounds silly like that I got to do my job was part of the surprise. But I actually do think that there's a nice bit in fellowship where I think you really get to pay attention to things that matter. You know, particularly at USC, it's such a great program. It's the where I wanted to be for fellowship for a few reasons. One is I've always been very dedicated to a county or a low-income population trying to expand medical care and access to them, particularly for diseases like, you know, multiple sclerosis. And, you know, I did a lot of my residency in county hospitals and actually USC's fellowship was the one I looked at that had the most exposure during the fellowship years to a county hospital and their population. And so that was one thing that I really look forward to being there. And Dr. Mespua and her research also dovetails perfectly well with that patient population and sort of to understand, you know, how does MS develop in diverse populations? We've studied white MS for so long. What does it look like, you know, across the US, across different income levels, across different ethnicities? And so, you know, the breadth to which, you know, we were able to, as fellows at USC, see patients, you know, who were coming to CAC, which is their academic medical center, which is a little bit fancier and takes the nicer insurance and has a nice big fountain outside. You know, and then go directly across the street. And this is sometimes, right, that shocking part. When you see the sort of segregation, the division in the healthcare system, you go literally across the street to the county hospital. You know, I don't think there's a fountain, there's metal detectors, you know, and we're really taking care of people that have, you know, Medicaid insurance or have no insurance and trying to make sure you're giving people, you know, what we think of as university level care, the highest level of care in these settings. It's doable. You can do it. But I think seeing the disparity on a daily basis, actually going literally across the street one to the other, that was shocking and remains shocking. No matter how many years I do it, it you know, you just never quite feel good doing it. And I think it's a reminder that, you know, for many of us in healthcare, for all of us, probably too, as Americans, if I can say, you know, looking for better equity and looking for ways to bridge these gaps is sort of a mission that seems to never end.
Well, speaking of looking for ways to bridge those sorts of gaps, I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that Dr. Maghavam and I know each other because we're both active members of the National MS Society's California Government Relations Advisory Committee. So let me ask you, what is it about advocacy that's important to you? And I think you may have already started to answer that question.
I could answer this question every which way. It's a deeply important part of the role as a physician. So, you know, I think, you know, many physicians have a different sort of conception of what their own role is in their community. For me, it's really being a community advocate and leader. And, you know, when I am seeing, for instance, my first year residency is an internship in internal medicine. When I'm seeing dozens of people come in with, you know, terrible uncontrolled diabetes, because they can't afford glucometers, keep an eye on their blood sugar. It makes me think bigger picture, how are we getting access to diabetes care for people? How can we prevent this? But likewise, when, you know, applied to neurology, certain things like the extraordinary prices of all of the treatments that can be life-saving, to me feels like, okay, we need to get together and really actually fight for something more just here. You know, when I walk across the street from two healthcare systems and I'm seeing the disparities there, I'm like, okay, we need to advocate to actually level the playing field here. And, you know, no matter what your orientation is on how you think, you know, society should look, there's something to advocate for, because there's always ways to change things for the better. And so for me as a physician, that's what I see as part of my role. I have this incredible honor of doing this work where people let me into their private lives and tell me things that are important to them. And, you know, I take some of that with me of, okay, well, I'm hearing this from so many people right now. This is the thing people aren't talking about out loud. Or if they are, they're not organized. How can we help? So to me, being on the committee with you, John, has been a wonderful experience. I've been in many advocacy roles before, but this one is particularly meaningful because of the great diversity of people we have on the committee, people living with MS, people who are the caretakers, myself as a healthcare provider. And I think as a last part to add on to why I think the advocacy to me is meaningful, I sort of mentioned in residency, you're just so burned out. But for me, actually, involvement in advocacy has always been my anti-burnout. So when I have been at my most stressed out, tired, sleep deprived, actually engaging in advocacy on different issues throughout my time in residency was one of the things that would sort of bring me energy and resettle me on like why I wanted to be a neurologist, why I wanted to be taking care of people who live with neurological conditions. So part of it's purely selfish, I guess. But, you know, in large part, I do think that a lot of this comes down to at least my personal conception of what it means to be a physician.
Well, Dr. Nuriel Maghavam, thank you for all you do in the clinic, through your research, and through your advocacy to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks, John. It's great as always.
Merck KGaA, which does business as EMD Serono in the United States and Canada, announced that their phase 3 clinical trial of evobrutinib has failed to meet its primary endpoints of reducing the annualized relapse rate among people with relapsing remitting MS compared to Aubagio. Evobrutinib is part of a promising new category of disease-modifying therapies called BTK inhibitors. These therapies work by blocking the activity of a specific protein that activates a certain type of immune cell that drives inflammation in MS. And this new class of medication is the only disease-modifying therapy that's been shown in clinical trials to deplete B cells in the brain. No one is quite sure whether these disappointing results will be replicated in clinical trials for other BTK inhibitors being developed by other pharmaceutical companies. We'll continue to update you as news from those trials is announced. Neurons are the most well-known cells in the central nervous system. Also called nerve cells, neurons are the long, wire-like cells that are wrapped in myelin, the cells that you see in all those diagrams that explain what MS is. And if you remember those explanations of MS, nerve cells send communications from the brain throughout the rest of the body. And in MS, when that myelin sheath that surrounds the nerve cell is damaged, those communications can be garbled. Research has shown that people living with progressive MS, with high levels of disability, have experienced an advanced loss of neurons. And the reason that I just gave you that refresher on the important role that neurons play is because I'm about to share something that may sound like science fiction, but it's not. Researchers from Tufts University and Harvard University have created tiny biological robots that they call anthrobots from human tracheal cells. These are the cells from your trachea, that membrane tube below your throat that conducts air to your lungs. These anthrobots range in size from the width of a human hair to the point of a pencil. They can be created from an individual's own cells without any genetic modification, so there aren't any rejection issues to worry about. and they have the ability to assemble themselves into larger multicellular superbots that can travel to different parts of the body and take on roles that are far different from their original roles as a cell living in the trachea. The reason I'm sharing this amazing news is that the research team reported that these anthrobots have demonstrated that they assemble as superbots, cover damaged neurons, and encourage the growth of new healthy neurons in their place. So there you have it. A breakthrough in science that sounds exactly like science fiction, but it isn't. And as the rate of scientific discovery continues to accelerate, I'm looking forward to sharing future breakthroughs that have the potential to be future game changers when it comes to replacing damaged nerve cells. If you'd like to review the details of this work, you'll find a link in today's show notes. And when we're talking about research breakthroughs, our conversation doesn't have to be limited to focusing on future application. In a moment, we'll meet a researcher who's continuing to create breakthrough treatments for improving cognitive dysfunction in people living with MS when we meet my guest, Dr. Nancy Chiravalotti. More than half the people living with MS experience cognitive changes, and these are the kinds of changes that can have a significant impact on your activities, your relationships, your employment, and your overall quality of life. Joining me to discuss how cognitive rehabilitation can help you learn to compensate and offset some of these changes is Dr. Nancy Chiravalotti. Dr. Chiravalotti is the director of the Center for Neuropsychology and Neuroscience Research and the Center for Traumatic Brain Injury Research at Kessler Foundation. She's also a research professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School. And Dr. Chiravalotti's research is focused on cognitive rehabilitation, particularly in new learning, memory, and processing speed. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Chiravalotti.
Thank you for having me.
So, which cognitive functions are commonly affected by MS, and what are some of the early signs of cognitive impairment?
The most common cognitive deficit that we see in persons with multiple sclerosis is in processing speed. So processing speed is a term that refers to following along and being able to process information quickly as it comes in. After processing speed, we also see quite a bit of deficit in new learning and memory. So that's also a very common cognitive deficit we see in persons with MS. Some people also experience other cognitive deficits, such as problems with executive functioning or attention, but those are less common than processing speed and new learning and memory. When someone feels like they are starting to experience cognitive deficits, what they typically report is that they're feeling cloudy or they're having trouble following along in a conversation. And that's particularly common when you have multiple people engage in the conversation, or you're in a very distracted environment, such as a cocktail party. So people may experience those types of things early on that kind of clue them into the fact that they may be starting to have some cognitive problems.
I know that people sometimes associate cognitive dysfunction with progressive MS. Is that an accurate assumption?
No. Cognitive deficits can occur across all subtypes of multiple sclerosis. Roughly 50% of people with relapsing remitting MS experience cognitive deficits. And then the incidence of cognitive deficits rise in the secondary progressive and primary progressive subtypes. So you can experience cognitive deficits no matter what type of MS you have.
So tell me, what is cognitive rehabilitation, and how might it help someone with MS?
So cognitive rehabilitation is a term that refers to a set of interventions. It's not only one treatment. It's a set of different interventions, but they all aim to improve a person's ability to perform cognitive tasks by retraining previously learned skills or teaching compensatory strategies. So cognitive rehabilitation does not involve medications. It's usually done with a therapist, either one-on-one or in a small group.
Cognitive rehabilitation includes restorative activities and compensatory activities. Can you help us understand the difference between the two and maybe share some examples?
Sure. Restorative cognitive rehabilitation seeks to improve cognitive functioning by strengthening the functions a person has lost or continues to find challenging. So restorative cognitive rehabilitation helps a person practice skills so that they can improve. And that builds upon the idea of neuroplasticity, which is the belief that the brain can change with practice. So restorative cognitive rehabilitation really refers to repetitive practice. Compensatory cognitive rehabilitation is a little bit different in that it helps a person develop new ways to do something. Compensatory cognitive rehabilitation can involve internal or external strategies. We all use external strategies. An example of that is using your iPhone to store your calendar and your to-do lists and your phone numbers. Everything goes in my phone so that I don't forget things. That's an external strategy that we all use. Internal strategies, a lot of people also use, and these are strategies where you do something, you process information a little bit differently to help you remember it. So as an example, you might use imagery to help you remember a person's name when you first meet them, or you might use imagery to help you remember a number. Like one of the things that I do is I'll visualize an old-fashioned telephone and where the numbers are on the face of the phone, and I'll use that to help me remember numbers. So a lot of us use internal strategies as well, and internal strategies can actually be very effective in helping us improve our learning and memory.
The modified story memory technique is something that was researched and developed by you and your colleagues at Kessler Foundation. And today it's considered class one evidence, meaning that it's been tested and proven to be highly effective at improving memory. Can you tell us about this therapy and how it can help people with MS?
Sure. The modified story memory technique is a 10-session cognitive rehabilitation program. The sessions are one-on-one. And through those 10 sessions, the person is taught to use two strategies to enhance their learning and memory. Sessions 1 through 4 focus on imagery. So we present a story and we ask people to form mental images of that story to help them remember it. As we go through different stories, we give them tips to help them form these mental images. Then we move on to sessions 5 through 8. And in sessions 5 through 8, we teach people to use context to help them remember information. So we're teaching people how to put unrelated information together into a meaningful context. Then we coach them to combine the imagery with the context to really help them learn new information. Finally, we have sessions 9 and 10, and in those sessions, we teach people how to actually do this in their everyday life.
Right about now, some of our listeners are wondering if modified story memory technique is available to them. How can someone determine whether their healthcare professional has been trained to administer this therapy?
So the best thing to do is to mention it to your healthcare professional and ask them. If the answer is no, that person can always get access to the program by reaching out to us. The training is straightforward, and we're always available to answer questions.
As you mentioned, processing speed is one of the most common cognitive impairments that affect people with MS. You led a clinical trial that studied ways to improve processing speed. What did you learn?
The program that we used in that trial was a program that had been shown to improve processing speed in healthy aging. And what we showed is that people with MS did show benefit on a task that was similar to the training task. So they did benefit from the treatment. However, that improvement did not generalize to daily life. And that's really important. That's what people care about, is how they function in daily life. So this was a restorative program, and it was focused on practicing a specific skill with different difficulty levels. So these results tell us that while the treatment worked, we need to do more and incorporate more in order to promote that generalization to daily life.
Recently published results from a large international clinical trial showed that cognitive rehabilitation and exercise can improve processing speed in people with progressive MS. We know that exercise is important for our physical health. How important is exercise or physical activity for our cognitive function?
It's extremely important. I cannot overemphasize the importance of being active. You don't have to run a marathon, but if you walk briskly every day, that's really going to help you maintain your cognitive function. And this is true for everyone, not only individuals who have multiple sclerosis. Exercise is very important to maintaining optimal cognition. And one of the things we're actually doing now is running a trial where we combine exercise with the story memory technique to see if we combine these two methods of improving cognition, do we get even better results.
What types of healthcare professionals are trained in cognitive rehabilitation, and how can someone go about finding a qualified professional?
There are several different types of professionals that are trained in cognitive rehabilitation. Certainly psychologists, they're probably in an outpatient setting, the most common professional that will administer cognitive rehabilitation. In a rehabilitation setting, you also see occupational therapists as well as speech therapists that are well-trained in administering cognitive rehabilitation. So really, those are really the three professions that focus on it. If you're looking to get some cognitive rehabilitation, the first thing I would do is talk to your neurologist. Neurologists generally have several neuropsychologists or cognitive therapists that they work with that they'll be able to refer you to. And this is particularly true if you go to an MS center. MS centers often have these different types of professionals that are part of their centers, and they work with them and refer their patients to them.
Well, Dr. Nancy Chiravalotti, thank you for all you do to improve the quality of life for people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/328. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.